an exposition of the Revelation in the view of Reformed premillennial historicism for the 21st century by Nicholas Arthur. Chapter 6, The Seven Seals Opening. Verse 1. And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, Come and see. Abstractions being thus presumptuously set aside, we seem very much reduced to the idea of some nation, an empire, or else the Christian church, being the main subject of the four horse symbols. And I think it will be admitted on this head that, whichever these two be chosen, the consistency of the symbols of a horse and a horseman, common to the four first seals, would seem to require a homogeneous interpretation of them. Hence, the exclusion of views, like Meade, who would explain the first seal's horse and rider with reference to Christ or his church, the three next seals, horse and riders, with reference to the Roman Empire or emperors. The rule is, of course, applicable in detail. What the horse singly is meant to symbolize in the first seal, whether the church or an empire, that it might reasonably be expected to symbolize in the next three seals, though under new and different aspects. As to the grand question just mooted, whether it be Christ's church or some nation and empire that is designated under the figure of the horse in these four seals, the presumption in favor of the former idea, which many have entertained, in consequence of its being Christ that appears crowned as the rider on a white horse in a later vision, like as the first seal rider also sat crowned on a white horse, that presumption, I believe, will utterly vanish before a more careful comparison of the two seals, for the only real point of resemblance will be found to be the mere and distinctive one of riding a white horse, while the differences will appear so many and so marked as to place the two symbolizations in the light of a marked contrast rather than an identity of subject. The impracticability, according to Vitringa, the most eminent probably of the church system advocates, of carrying out an explanation of the horse and horseman on this system into the second, third, and fourth seals, otherwise than as one compound emblem, increases the already strong presumption against that view, besides that the fitness of a horse to designate the church, even supposing Vitringa's difficulty to be overcome, seems very questionable. Nor am I persuaded will human learning or ingenuity ever be found to be able to carry out satisfactorily a detailed historical explanation of the four seals on this view of the horse as signifying the church. First seal, verse 2. And I saw, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. That which must shortly come to pass. A.D. 98. Not the javelin, not the sword, but a bow, a well-known sign of the Crete, to mark the new succession of emperors who should reign through these prosperous times. First Nerva, himself of Cretan birth, then Trajan and Adrian and the Antonines, each adopted by his predecessor in a manner peculiar to these five emperors, all therefore reckoned, in strict accordance with the Roman law of adoption, as of Nerva's family, and emperors of the same, the Nervan dynasty, in whom resided the ruling power during this period. And therefore a crown was given unto him to mark the rider's imperial character. It was the laurel crown, to mark the times, and not the diadem of later days. And he went forth conquering and to conquer. and this throughout a period of 80 or 90 years, of which it might be said a golden age had appeared, of prosperity at home and of success abroad, scarce to be paralleled in history, one unstained with civil blood, but victorious wherever foreign wars were waged, against Suevi, Dacians, Britons, Moors, Germans, Jews, or Parthians. If a man were called to fix the period in history of the world during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would, without hesitation, name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the accession of Commodus, i.e., the period of the five emperors from Nerva to the second Antonine. The armies were restrained by the firm and gentle hand of these five successive emperors. The delight was theirs of beholding the general happiness of which they were the authors, and they, therefore, are represented by the writer under this seal. Second Seal, Verse 3. And when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, Come and see. And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. A.D. 185. The condition of the empire was changed. Was given unto him a great sword. A principle of disorder and distress began to appear. The first symptoms of dissolution showed themselves, and peace was so taken from the inhabitants that they should kill one another, that is, in civil war. He that sat and ruled was no longer he who wore the imperial crown, into whose hand the real authority now had passed, the last expressive symbol thus plainly indicated, and there was given unto him a great sword, the acknowledged symbol of the military profession, and more especially indicative in the manner of its presentation under the Roman rule, of the offices of the Praetorian Prefect at Rome itself, and of the imperial lieutenants in the provinces, the highest and greatest of the Roman military functionaries. And behold, a system of military despotism comes in. Revolution and civil war and bloodshed stain the page of history. The licentious fury of the Praetorian Guards was the first symptom and cause of the decline of the Roman Empire. The second seal is open, and behold, upon the second living creature's voice like thunder, the white horse has passed from view, a symbol of the Roman nation in joyous prosperity and triumph, and another, a red horse, passes over the scene before the eyes of John, depicting it under the color of war and bloodshed. But what kind of bloodshed? The explanatory words that were added defined it to be that of civil war, that they should kill one another. Commodus, the first emperor of this bloody period, is assassinated. In a few days his successor meets the same doom. In the space of a half a century, nine emperors are murdered. So dreadful were the deeds of blood through this fearful period, within the limits of the empire itself, not in foreign war, that the crimson dye of its emblematical horse could alone denote its blood-stained condition. The dissolute tyranny of Commodus, the civil wars occasioned by his death, and the new maxims of policy introduced by the house of Severus had all contributed to increase the dangerous power of the army. This internal change, which undermined the foundation of the empire, we have endeavored to explain with some degree of order and perspicuity. The personal characters of the emperors, their victories, laws, follies, and fortunes can interest us no farther than as they are connected with the general history of the decline and fall of the monarchy. Third Seal, Verse 5. And when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, Come and see. And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, A measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny. And see thou hurt not the oil and the wine. The intent of the figuration in this seal is less obvious than in the two former, and will require some considerable thought and attention, though the change of the horse's color to black can scarce be mistaken as indicating generally the change to a state of aggravated distress and mourning. Let us therefore first consider the usually received, but as will appear, incorrect solution, then, second, apply ourselves to seek one more correct and satisfactory. 1. A famine of the chief articles of food, whether literally taken or metaphorically, has been supposed by nearly all interpreters to be implied in the other details of poetic passage as the cause of the distress indicated, their opinion being grounded on these two suppositions. First, that the coinage spoken of was the common Attic coinage. Second, that the specified prices for such a measure of wheat and barley were famine prices. Of course, the average prices near about the time of Domitian and St. John's exile in Patmos, not those of quite other times, must be the standard of reference. And judging by what the elder Pliny reports of prices not very long before, we shall find that, though the price of wheat here named might be a scarcity price, it could hardly be called one of famine. Then, moreover, what of the very singularly added specification of the price of barley? 3 coinixes of barley for a denarius. Surely this is one such as to put the idea of famine altogether out of the question. For, to state the argument in its simplest form, for as much as the Attic coinix was proverbially the day's sufficient quota for a man of wheat or barley, and at the same time a denarius was approximately the daily wages of labor in St. John's time, the price specified would indicate that a laboring man would gain under the seal nearly 3 days' sufficiency of barley bread, above 5 pounds in weight, by 1 day's labor. Did ever man hear of such a famine as this? Thus, even were no other difficulty to oppose it, yet would the famine hypothesis break down utterly on this one single account. But in fact, beside this, all else in the figuration, except indeed the black color of the horse, is opposed to it. The signal of the state of mourning and distress, into which the whole empire would next be thrown, for a new principle of decay is introduced. Oppressive taxation is inflicted upon the Roman provinces by the enactment of Caracalla's edict, whereby the Roman city was made coextensive with the Roman world, and its taxation in consequence superadded to the burden of the tributes which the provinces had already to bear. I beheld this horse, and he that sat on him, as a representative of the provincial governors, who would enforce a new and oppressive edict, had a pair of balances in his hand, the well-known badge of office, which the provincial governors had in token a professed impartiality in the execution of the laws. But grievous was the oppression which the new edict began to introduce, aggravated as it was by the iniquity of the corrupt local administration. It is our attention to that great subject, the decline and fall of the monarchy, that will not suffer us to overlook the important edict of Caracalla, as Gibbon proceeds to say in connection with the subject of Roman taxation. For a complete and thorough analysis of the third seal, see E.B. Eliot's Jorge Apocalypticae. Fourth seal, verse 7. And when he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, Come and see. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth, to kill with the sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beasts of the earth. One more epoch of decay was necessary for the mighty Roman Empire to endure before its division into the ten horns, and its imperial power being taken out of the way, accomplished, before that man of sin to be revealed. There is no research needed here to explain the intent of the prefigured symbol, the pale horse. The rider was not, as before, the representative of human functionaries and rulers, whose distinctive emblems, though well understood at the time, might now require investigation to unfold them. It is a symbol of meaning, as obvious to the reader now as it could have been then to the seer. For the agent meant is expressly told to us. It was the personification of death, to mark that it was the actual king of terrors, and not, as otherwise it might possibly have been construed, the destroyer merely of political existence. His badge, so to express it, is said to have been Hades following him, the recipient, with his opening jaws, of the victim slain by death. The commission was given to him by the supreme arbiter of life and death, to kill upon the Roman earth with all the four sword judgments of God, with the sword, and with famine, and with pestilence, and with the wild beasts of the earth. And the horse, symbolizing the Roman Empire and people, appeared deadly pale and livid under his influence, a hue symptomatic, apparently, of approaching dissolution. An era of terrible mortality, and to an extent scarce precedent in the annals of human history, was here evidently prefigured. The question for us is, was there then such an era in the Roman imperial history, and one following on that of the seal preceding? The answer is soon given. An era in the Roman history commencing with 14 or 15 years after the death of Alexander Severus is so strongly marked by coincidence in every point with this terrible prefigured emblem that interpreters who explain the six first seals of the history of pagan Rome one and all agree in referring the fourth seal to it. For my own part, having given Gibbon's testimony so much as my authority in illustration of the former seals, I wish to give him, though not exclusively, on this also, and after all, who so graphic an illustrator, who like him for extracting the spirit of contemporary history and infusing it, concentrated into his own painting? He speaks then of the period from the celebration of the great secular games by the Emperor Philip, A.D. 248, to the death of Gallienus, A.D. 268, as the 20 years of shame and misfortune, of confusion and calamity. He speaks of it as a time in which, mark again the correspondence of his figure with the death-like color of the horse in the apocalyptic emblem, quote, the ruined empire seemed to approach the last and fatal moment of its dissolution. He depicts the various agencies of destruction consuming it, the sword. Every instant of time was marked, every province of the Roman world was afflicted by barbarous invaders and military tyrants. The sword came from without, and the sword from within. Famine, quote, our habits of thinking, he says, so fondly connect the order of the universe with the fate of man, that this gloomy period has been decorated with inundations, earthquakes, uncommon meteors, preternatural darkness, and a crowd of prodigies fictitious, or exaggerated.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Arthur, and I'd like to introduce you to my latest book, Reformed Prophecy Interpretation, an apology for Reformed premillennial historicism in the 21st century. As with primitive biblical Christianity, historicism is the method of prophecy interpretation restored with the advent of the Protestant Reformation, and had become so widely held that for a long time it was called the Protestant view. My book is not so much about the errors of dispensationalism or amillennialism. Rather, it is about the historicist alternative to understanding many of the same passages from the vantage point of prophecy fulfilled in history. For those that desire more than mere hypotheses, bolstered with conjectured speculation, those who require explicit biblical exegesis and verified historical fulfillment, and are not willing to accept speculation as anything other than what it is. Speculation, not truth. This book is for you. Over the last century, this method of interpretation has become almost completely forgotten, even by Protestants, in the face of a method that is based almost entirely on future speculation, rather than fulfilled prophecy in history. In my book, I examine the reasons for this and investigate some of the prophecy which has been fulfilled in the interim, as well as present an apology for Reformed premillennial historicism to the 21st century. If you're interested in a copy of my book, you can go to my website, crosstheborder.org, and get more information there. Or you may also find it at Amazon. An exposition of the Revelation in the view of Reformed premillennial historicism for the 21st century by Nicholas Arthur. Chapter 6, The Seven Seals Opening. Continued. Fifth Seal. And when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God, and for the testimony which they held. Thus the scene now depicted in the altar court was one not of living worshippers, but dead. The voice heard, one not of psalm or praise, but of suffering. It issued from beneath the altar, and came, as the sacred description tells us, from the souls of them that had been slain for the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. Shadowy human forms appearing there, we may suppose, since white robes are afterwards said to have been given to them. Perhaps like those Elohim seen ascending out of the earth in olden times by King Saul. There was prefigured, evidently, some notable era of persecution against the church, carried out by them that dwell on the earth, i.e., the Roman rulers and people, they having been raised up, apparently, in strength to effect it, from the destroying judgments of the seal preceding, a persecution of virulence, such that other visible worship and witnessing for the faith would now be suppressed, and this would alone remain to Christians, to offer themselves, as it were, in sacrifice, in the cause, as well as after the example of their dying master, or, as St. Paul expresses it, to pour out their souls in libation at the foot of his altar. And of this the historical fulfillment is most striking. Little as was the probability of such an event, during the desolating judgments of the earlier half of the fourth seal, the Roman Empire was raised up from its state of imminent dissolution, oppressed and almost destroyed, as it had been, to use Gibbon's language, under the deplorable reigns of Valerian and Gallienus. It was saved by a series of great princes, Claudius, Aurelian, Probus, Diocletian, and his colleagues, who, within a period of about 30 years, triumphed over the foreign and domestic enemies of the state, and deserved the title of Restorers of the Roman World. It is observable, indeed, that, although raised up in its integrity, it was not so, practically speaking, in its unity. A quadripartite division under two senior emperors, the Augusti, and two juniors, the Caesars, having been instituted by Diocletian, so as already observed by me under the fourth seal, as necessary to provide against the difficulties and dangers that now on every side claimed the imperial attention, so that the dissolution of the horse, the symbol previously of the undivided empire, had in fact taken place. The empire under its old constitution was no more. Like Augustus, Diocletian may be considered as the founder of a new empire. Still, the restoration was effective. The empire revived in strength, but only to exhibit in signal display the spirit of enmity to Christianity that animated it. During the progress of its restoration, indeed, the Christian churches enjoyed toleration and rest. No sooner, however, had the restoration been completed, in fact, in the very same year that auspicious consummation was celebrated by Diocletian in his triumph at Rome, the last triumph that Rome ever saw, in that same year, A.D. 303, the persecution that we speak of began. It was early that year, in the royal palace of Nicomedia, that secret and ominous councils began between Diocletian himself and Galerius, the eastern Caesar previously nominated by him. Maximian, the other Augustus, though absent, was understood to concur with them. The destruction of Christianity was the subject. Perhaps, says Gibbon, it was represented to Diocletian that the glorious work of the deliverance of the empire was left imperfect so long as an independent people, the Christians, were permitted to subsist and multiply in the heart of the provinces. Then the blow was struck. On the 23rd of February, the mission of an armed force to destroy the great church of Nicomedia and burn the sacred books in it was the signal for commencing persecution. A persecution the longest and most universal and the fiercest that yet ever raged against the Christians. History alike, secular and ecclesiastical, agrees in thus representing it, and by a remarkable coincidence, and as if on purpose to call attention to the fulfillment in this persecution of the fifth seal's prefigured vision, a chronological era dating from Diocletian's accession and until the introduction of the Christian era in the sixth century, of general use among Christian writers. I say this era, though instituted for other and astronomical purposes, has received its title from it, and is called the Era of Martyrs. Churches to be demolished, the Holy Scriptures burned, church property confiscated, the holders of religious assemblies put to death, and Christians generally put out of the protection of the law. Such were the heads of the first edict. Then followed others, imposing penalties of imprisonment, tortures, and death, first against the Christian bishops, presbyters, and other ecclesiastics, then against all Christians, if obstinate in their faith. In this series of cruel edicts, Diocletian declared his intention of abolishing the Christian name. The fury of the populace, readily, for the most part, seconded the declared intention of the emperor. And thus, with the partial exception of the western provinces, under the rule of Caesar Constantius Chlorus, I say partial, for Spain and Britain also furnished many victims. Christian blood was shed throughout the extent of the Roman world. And long before the 9 or 10 years of the persecution passed, such had been its effect that the three other emperors, Diocletian, Maximian, and Galerius, united to raise pillars commemorative of their success, on which pillars inscriptions, not long since, and perhaps still extant, recorded their vain boast of having extirpated Christianity. For church service, the Christians now met in caves and catacombs. Their only way of visibly and publicly witnessing for Christ was by martyrdom. Verse 10. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? In the words, how long, it was further implied to the evangelist, as I before observed, that although this persecution was the first and only one noted in the prefigure visions thus far exhibited, yet it would not be then a new thing for Christian blood to be shed by them that dwell on the Roman earth, including, as the word signified, both rulers and people, but only a continuance or repetition of the treatment long previously experienced by them. To verify this is my next object, and in doing so I must crave permission from the reader not to hurry over the investigation. A sketch of the persecutions of Christianity in the Roman Empire is almost necessary to our entering into the feelings expressed in the words, How long? By the souls under the altar, and afterward dwelling so much at length on the secular fortunes of the Roman Empire throughout the two preceding centuries, it seems scarce allowable not to pause a while on the contemporaneous and parallel history, as connected with it, of the Church of Christ. Verse 11, And white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said to them that they should rest yet for a little season, until their fellow servants, also and their brethren, that should be killed as they were, should be fulfilled. The church, having passed through the 10 primitive persecutions, is here indicated to soon pass into a new epoch of persecution and martyrdom following this first phase represented. Thus, in a series of consecutive, consistent figurations, each one of a symbolic horse and horseman passing forth in the vision, as I suppose, over the Roman landscape, and repeated in this homogeneous form until the mind of the evangelist must have become familiarized with them, and until the obvious presumptive solution of the three last, on the same principle of Roman reference, must have illustrated and confirmed in his mind that which we have expounded as the most simple and natural interpretation of the first. In this series, I say, the imminent secular fortunes of the great military empire of Rome had been prefigured to St. John, as time would in its lapse unfold them, first and under the rule of a new line of emperors, an era of remarkable and protracted prosperity and triumph, next under the abuse of the power of the sword, a commencing era of as remarkable civil warfare and bloodshed. Then, as on a scale of suffering suddenly enlarged, an era of aggravated misery from the added iniquitous administration and fiscal oppression of them to whom rightfully appertained the balances of equity, with a notice of the last vain reclamations of law and justice against them, and consequently marked triumph of official corruption. Lastly, an era characterized by the letting loose on the devoted empire of the judgments of sword, famine, pestilence, and wild beasts, the evils of the two preceding seals themselves still in force. Having, in fact, prepared the way for these four sore judgments of God, under which, at length, the very vitality of the empire seemed threatened, the pale and livid hue of this horse indicative of approaching dissolution. Sixth Seal, Verse 12. And I beheld, And when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell unto earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs, when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And the heaven departed as a scroll, when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every free man, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, Fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? Sixth seal, primary vision. First, then, it should be distinctly understood that the expressions here used respecting the earthquake and the phenomena in the sun, moon, and stars cannot be interpreted literally or as referring to those physical changes in the material earth and firmament of heaven, which other prophecies lead us undoubtedly to expect at the consummation of the great day. The clearest literal description of these physical changes is perhaps that given in 2 Peter 3:10. The day of the Lord shall come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens, the firmament, shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat, and the earth also, and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Now a conflagration like this, no hint is given in the vision of the sixth seal. Moreover, in such conflagration, neither would the sun become black as sackcloth, nor the moon appear blood red, still less the stars fall to the ground. The expression must be taken metaphorically, and as referring to political changes, like those in other parallel prophecies just before referred to. There seems to me a physical necessity for this from what is said, as well as almost a necessity from what is not said, besides the necessity arising from the requirements of symbolic language in a confessedly symbolic prophecy. Thus, just as on the fifth seal's opening, the evangelist's eye had been directed from the terrene landscape to the nearer altar court, so now it was directed back from the altar court to the terrene landscape, with which landscape the temple and holy city adjoining were, as before observed, associated, and which seems to have appeared with both seas and land outspread in view, and with the heaven or sky and heavenly luminaries above them. It imaged evidently the Roman world, that in which the Christian church had already planted itself, and with which its future fortunes were, in God's providence, to be most closely connected, even to the end. And as the Jewish-like apocalyptic temple did fitly symbolize the faith and worship of Christ's people through an atoning and mediating Redeemer, the same that the ancient Jewish temple, altar, sacrifices, and priesthood had ever while standing prefigured, and moreover the holy city symbolized their polity as the aspirant and constituent members of the kingdom of heaven, so was the earth outspread in the vision, as fitly emblematic of its heathen inhabitants, even as of a people in taste, principle, and feeling, belonging only to this world of the earth, as St. Paul expresses it, and earthy, the heaven above, this apocalyptic earth, was, we must remember, its own firmament, heaven, or sky, being altogether distinct from that spiritual unchanging heaven constituted by the divine presence in the inner temple. According to the usual scripture use of such terms, it was to be considered as representing the ruling department in the dominant polity and its luminaries as the actual rulers and governing powers therein. So when the sixth seal was opened, these luminaries appeared fixed in the sky, and the earth at rest and still. But behold, on its opening, the whole scene in agitation. A great and sudden earthquake shakes the earth. The mountains and the island rocks sink beneath the shock. The sun becomes black, the full moon blood red, as in total eclipse. The stars fall from heaven in which they were before shining, even as figs from a fig tree in a windy tempest. Kings and generals, rich men and great men, free men and slaves, dressed probably in a measure distinguishing them, appear in flight, as panic-stricken, and seeking to caves or holes in the rocks wherein to hide themselves. And this was chiefly observable, that in the city which St. John heard uttered by them, no earthly foe was named as their object of terror. They spoke as men conscious that Jesus, who was crucified, was their conqueror and their foe. They called on the rocks to hide them from him who sat upon the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. The general intent of this vision does not seem to me to have been difficult to understand. It surely portended some sudden and extraordinary revolution in the Roman Empire, which would follow chronologically after the era of martyrdom depicted under the seal preceding, a revolution arising from the triumph of the Christian cause over its enemies, and in degree complete and universal. No partial change would answer to the strength of the symbolic phraseology, nor again any mere overthrow of the persecuting emperors by their milder and more tolerant but still heathen emperors. Nothing less would answer than a destruction of heathenism itself throughout the empire, before the progress and power of Christianity, or at least a sweeping from their high places in it of heathen ruling powers and authorities. And this not through the gentle progress of opinion, but with circumstances of force accompanying, such as to strike those heathen opposers with consternation and dismay. Let us look then to history to see whether, so interpreted, the vision received its accomplishment. And thus, in short, not only did the luminaries of the Roman world become eclipsed and the stars fall to the earth, but the heaven, the pagan heaven itself, which covered the Roman Empire, departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places, army after army, emperor after emperor, for after Diocletian's division, there were several contemporary emperors or kings of the earth. So Gibbon, after noting Diocletian's change of government, three or four magnificent courts were established in the various parts of the empire, and as many Roman kings contended with each other for the vain superiority of pomp and luxury, was routed and fled and perished in consternation before the cross and its warriors. Such was the case with Maxentius, Maximin, and Licinius after his apostasy to the pagan cause. In the war, Constantine, Licinius after his apostasy, says Gibbon, felt and dreaded the power of the consecrated banner, the sight of which, in the distress of battle, animated the soldiers of Constantine with invincible enthusiasm and scattered terror and dismay throughout the ranks of the adverse legion. Gibbon. There was a consciousness that the powers of heaven, and above all the crucified one, the Christians' God, were against them. The war was felt to be a religious war. It was a struggle between the champions of heathenism and the champion of the cross. In the persecution just preceding, the emperors Diocletian and Maximin had struck medals of themselves in the characters and names of Jove and Hercules, destroying the serpent-like hydra-headed monster, Christianity. And these pagan titles had been adopted by their successors. When Maximin went forth to engage Licinius, he made his vow to Jupiter that, if successful, he would extirpate Christianity. When Licinius, again, after his wretched apostasy, was marching against Constantine and his crusaders, he ridiculed the cross in public harangue before his soldiers and staked the falsehood of Christianity on his success. In all these cases, the terror of defeat was aggravated by a sense of their gods having failed them, and of the power of heaven being with Christ, the Christian God. And the dying horrors also of one and another of these persecuting emperors are recorded in history and stand as an example of what all who eagerly participated in this fearful struggle against the cross must have experienced themselves. The consternation which history depicts is only a counterpart of the prophetic vision. The ruin of the pagan religion is described by the sophists as a dreadful and amazing prodigy which covered the earth with darkness and restored the ancient dominion of chaos and night. Hosea 10:8. The thorn and thistle shall come up upon their altars, and they shall say to the mountains, "Cover us," and to the hills, "Fall on us." In which passage, as in the vision of the sixth seal, the falling on them is evidently meant of the caverned or hollowed hills falling, not to crush, but to hide. Similar to this is the language in Luke 23:30. Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, "Fall on us," and to the hills, "Cover us," with reference first to the sufferings in the siege of Jerusalem, and further also, as appears from the word "begin," to the sufferings of the dispersion afterwards.
Calvary, that's the place where Jesus bled and died, and it's there that sin has lost its power, at Calvary. Calvary, there my Jesus won the victory, there he gave himself. Brother, give no thought for what tomorrow it may bring. Your Father, he knows your heart. He knows your every need. Just seek him in his truth and rest upon his word. Share his love to everyone. Let's all just praise the Lord. Let the stars fall from the skies. Let the sun refuse to shine. In darkness, I know there will be a light for all mankind. It doesn't matter who you are or whatever things you've done. 'Cause Jesus, he still loves you and calls for you to come to Calvary. That's the place where Jesus bled and died, and it's there that sin has lost its power, at Calvary. Calvary, that's the place where Jesus bled and died, sin has lost its power at Calvary. Calvary. There my Jesus won the victory. There he gave himself for you.